Tomorrow will mark 5 years since the Oso landslide that took down a hillside and killed 43 people just north of Arlington, wiped out an entire community. Efforts have been underway to create a permanent memorial at the site of that slide. And tomorrow, part of that memorial will be unveiled as the families of those killed and survivors gather for the five-year remembrance ceremony. And KYRadio's Hannah Scott has that report. Hannah?
Most of the 43 lives lost at the slide were people living in Oso's Steelhead Haven neighborhood. The slide swallowed the neighborhood, leaving behind little more than mounds of debris, a broken hillside, and the shattered dreams of the families that, in some cases, lost generations. When the nearly 50 homes that made up the neighborhood were still standing and those living there were still enjoying their quiet paradise, there was one thing they all shared: a cluster of mailboxes just off State Route 530 that, on top of doing its job of receiving mail, served as a landmark, a point of reference for locals giving directions to one of their many summer barbecues, the place where balloons were tied to mark a child's birthday party. Home. This is what Seattle sculptor Louise McDowell was tasked with capturing when she was selected to recreate the mailbox sculpture as part of the memorial that will be unveiled at tomorrow's five-year remembrance ceremony.
And that was such a powerful symbol of what was there, the memories that people still had of that place, which is home, was home for them.
While she had no direct connection to the slide or those impacted by it, she remembers it like it was yesterday.
It was just such a horrific thing that happened. It was so close to home and just really touched me. Just knowing how much the survivors and the friends, you know, were going to be dealing with the loss of all those people and of how awful it was for the people who were in that slide when that mud came down.
And that's why when the families and representatives from Snohomish County launched a search last year for an artist to create the mailbox sculpture, McDowell felt compelled to put her hat in the ring.
That was something that I could do. I could recreate those mailboxes.
And she had read about it, the search for the artist, in the newspaper. And she was one of five to submit a proposal and was eventually selected because of her prior work with bronze. An honor, but no easy task for several reasons, including what little she had to base her design on.
They have a picture of the mailboxes, and that was the only picture that they had, with those mailboxes covered with snow and looking very, very dark. And what they wanted was an artist to recreate it somehow from that one picture.
And once she was able to get past that, the even bigger challenge, getting it right. She went to the slide site first, and after looking at the 43 trees that were planted as a memorial to the victims there, she had some ideas.
Things were being left by those trees that were significant, things that would remind a person of the person when he was alive. So somebody that had a lot of bird cages or birds, or sort of children who had died, they were athletic equipment like a ball or a mitt. And in keeping with that, I had proposed putting an object into the mailboxes. But the feelings of the people who remained were still so raw that this was too much.
It was too difficult for the survivors to get too personal with the design.
No, it just needed to be the mailboxes. And the title that we came up with was that it says, "This was home." And it's perfect. The mailboxes themselves represented home.
So McDowell kept it simple. It's a slightly larger-than-life replica of these mailboxes with as many of the actual addresses on the boxes as she could disintegrate. And this will be placed right at the site of the memorial. At this point, she just hopes she's got it right.
Yeah.
This one means a lot. And I'm just hoping that it says what it needs to say to people who are up there.
She had it delivered to the staging area in Monroe a couple of days ago, and it sounds like everyone who's seen it so far has a very positive response.
I hadn't thought of that, but every rural neighborhood has clusters of mailboxes like that, which over time, you know, in our own community, you know, they have these little covers and the lids get moss on them, and each mailbox has its own character sometimes.
Yeah, and it does. You can see pictures of the loan pictures she's talking about that she worked off of, and the replica that she's designed at mynorthwest.com. And it really does capture it. And I've talked to the family members and the survivors over the past year about as they were having this worked on, and it really does matter so much to them. It encompasses the heart of that community in a very simple statement that will be there right at the side of the slide.
Car Radio's Hannah Scott, who has been reporting on this since the beginning. Thank you, Hannah. Choke points.
Let's go.
Brought to you by Online Trading Academy. Tacoma drivers have been dealing with a never-ending series of lane changes on I-5 as the state adds HOV lanes to the freeway. And now there is only one major shift left before the project is complete. So this could all end when, Chris?
In about 3 years.
In about 3 years.
I mean,
years.
We still have a lot of work to do, but in terms of the impact on drivers and the changing target of what your lanes are, that is going to be better. You might have noticed this week that some of the I-5 lanes have moved a little bit around the work zone. They've shifted to the outsides of the freeway a little bit to allow the third and final overpass to be torn down over the freeway.
We've also shifted lanes on northbound and southbound I-5 between McKinley and Portland Avenue. We've shifted them out slightly so that there's work now taking place in the center median.
The Washington Department of Transportation's Kara Mitchell says the L Street overpass, like Portland Avenue and McKinley Avenue overpasses before it, needs to come down so the state can add HOV lanes through the city.
What we have to do is take the old bridges out, widen the area on either side of the freeway so that we can add additional lanes, and then we rebuild the overpass so that those new bridge piers aren't in the way of future lanes.
So that overpass is going to start coming down on Monday. In April, drivers are going to have to endure some overnight closures as that demolition continues. The biggest impact for that will be on the April 12th and 13th. That's when I-5 is going to be reduced to a single lane as sections over the freeway are going to come down. And then the last big traffic shift of this entire project will move all southbound I-5 traffic onto the northbound lanes of the freeway over the Puyallup River.
We will be moving three lanes of southbound I-5 onto the new northbound Puyallup River Bridge. And there will also be a collector-distributor lane for drivers coming from Port of Tacoma Road to southbound I-5.
It will take just under 3 years to build the new southbound bridge and the new L Street overpass. And southbound drivers will remain in those northbound lanes for the duration. Mitchell says the state didn't want to make a bunch of small traffic shifts, recognizing that Tacoma drivers have suffered through that enough.
One big traffic shift that's going to be happening here this spring, and then you stay in that configuration until the end of the project. We're not going to have multiple shifts for 1 year, and then we move into another year for a different shift.
So it looks like about 3 more years of pain through Tacoma before the construction that's been going on nearly continuously for, at that point, 25 years will be complete. Target date is sometime finishing is around 2021. That's about the same time that some of the I-5 widening project through JBLM is going to wrap up. But another piece of that I-5 widening from the main gate of JBLM through the Steilacoom DuPont Road will not be finished until 2025. So technically a little further south of Tacoma, we're still going to be dealing with a lot of orange cones for at least the next 6 years.
And then it'll be done, or they're going to take it apart again because it'll still be too small?
Well, yeah, the whole thing is that you hope by the time it's all said and done, it won't be obsolete. Because there are so many people coming here and there. But, you know, adding those HOV lanes and the direct access lanes between Highway 16 and I-5, I think will make a difference, providing just kind of like what we saw, you know, in Renton with the new flyover ramp. Right. So to eliminate some of that weaving that we see every day, especially every morning, trying to get from Highway 16 through all those city center exits and then back onto I-5.
You know, if they had adopted my Lego idea for highway construction, just be putting a few extra blocks in there and you'd be fine.
Yeah, well, who's going to move those blocks, Dave?
That's true. That's true. This is Seattle's Morning News. Is it time, after 20 years, to bring back state-sponsored affirmative action in Washington State? Former State Representative Jesse Weinberry is pushing this initiative, and you have gathered, this is to the legislature, so it goes to them first. You gathered how many signatures?
395,938 signatures, Dave, and that's not only enough signatures to be certified, but it was the highest number of signatures that has ever been submitted for any initiative to the legislature in Washington State history.
Initiative 200 originally said that you could not give any preference, correct, to somebody based solely on race.
or other categories?
Actually, you're close. An I-200 or Initiative 200 called for the ban of the use of race or gender as factors in affirmative action in three areas. Education, so obviously getting into colleges and universities. Right. Employment, getting a job, not just with state, with the state jobs, but with state, county, municipal, city, school district, port commission. And then finally, the third leg of that three-legged stool is contracting, that neither race nor gender can be could be factors in awarding state contracts.
So if I-1000 were to pass, race and these other categories could be considered a factor, but not the only factor.
Exactly.
Now, a factor, assuming everything else was equal in terms of qualification?
Exactly. You cannot take someone who's less qualified and leapfrog someone who is more qualified solely based on race or gender. Mm-hmm. Everybody agrees with that. I mean, nobody should be hired for a job or get into a school or be awarded a contract just because of two factors that have more to do with their birth than anything else. However, diversity is something that is a goal throughout America. And in order to achieve that diversity, you have to be able to recruit people that are different than people currently in the workforce or that are different in the classroom to diversify that classroom in a university. So I-1000 basically says what the nation does now.
So if the rule is, for example, you have to have an SAT score of 1100 to get in. Before you can consider race, you have to have that score.
One simple word, qualified. Everyone has to first and foremost be qualified for that seat at a college, be qualified for that job, or be qualified for that contract. And then the other gender and race factors can be considered.
You also, though, say that you can't have quotas.
Exactly.
Right? Okay, so tell me how that works.
Well, a lot of people think that you can have quotas, and they almost confuse affirmative action and diversity with quotas. But what most of the public isn't aware of is that quotas were outlawed in the United States of America back in 1978-79 with the Bakke decision, Bakke against the University of California at Berkeley. But a lot of states have not adopted that Supreme Court decision, and we do in I-1000. We all agree, Democrats, Republicans, independents, male, female, no matter what community you come from, that quotas should be prohibited, and we prohibit quotas in I-1000.
You're backing this because you're betting that a lot has changed in 20 years, am I correct?
A lot has changed in 20 years, number one.
In terms of the electorate, anyway.
Absolutely. I mean, 20 years ago, there were about 3 million people, between 3 and 4 million people that lived in Washington State. Now it's north of 7 million people. And we did a poll, Dave, of a statewide poll that showed that 65% of the people who intend to vote in this election want to vote affirmative action back into law as long as it covers four groups: women, people of color, disabled, and military veterans. And I-1000 covers all four.
Adds those groups. I'm surprised those weren't there already. I mean, don't we already have programs for certainly for veterans, don't we?
Well, here's what's interesting. In Washington State, there's affirmative action for veterans, but only two categories of veterans. You have to be either a Vietnam-era veteran or disabled. So if you didn't fight during the Vietnam War, and really, if you're not disabled, you don't qualify for affirmative action. And so I-1000 expands it to include all honorably discharged military veterans, no matter what war they fought in.
You must also have a reason for feeling this is still needed. I know that when Initiative 200 was passed, University of Washington tried to maintain its diversity by using income as a reason to give somebody an advantage on the presumption that if you're a minority, you tend to be low income. The criterion of income is a little more accepted than the criterion of race, at least among some groups. Why wouldn't that be enough as a way to create diversity?
Well, because number one, not all African Americans are suffering from income disparity. The other reason is because what we've been told by the University of Washington is that they also try to use zip code because they can't. When you and I were going to college, we could send in a photo of ourselves with our application, and there were boxes to check. I mean, I was able to check African American. Yeah. those boxes are gone because of I-200. You can't send a photo in. And so they're really, it's just a crapshoot when they're using NCOM or zip code, because there may be a person that comes through with a name similar to Jesse Weinberry, and he ends up not being a person of color. Well, but and so they filled a seat, and they were trying to increase diversity, and they didn't. And I also think that it's also going to sometimes depend on the profession. I spoke with the superintendent of public instruction, who was over all of our public schools, Chris Recto, the other day, and he said, you know what our challenge is in terms of increasing diversity in our teachers? And I said, what? And he said, men. He said, so I look at I-1000 as a way to increase the number of men who have an opportunity to be in those classrooms in front of those kids and showing the diversity of gender. And right now he said that 92% of those 89,000 teachers are women, and that they are desperate to hire men of all races who want to teach and make an impact on children's lives. And he said, I-1000 opens the door for us to use gender to recruit to fill many of those jobs.
Well, I mean, gender's being redefined, Jesse. It turns out to be fluid. So I hope it goes well. I think there's going to be like hundreds of boxes there to check eventually.
Well, I think for the last 20 years, we engaged in the experiment of I-200, where you can't use race, you can't use gender, and we've seen that it didn't work so well. I mean, even on the contracting side, the state has now reported that over that 20-year period, women-owned businesses and minority businesses lost $3.5 billion that had gone to them the previous 20 years. So now we move to the next phase of trying it differently. I think you're going to see more diversity.
Former State Representative Jesse Weinberry, sponsor of Initiative 1000. Thanks very much.
No, thank you, Dave.
And, of course, they're going to try and get the legislature to pass Initiative 1000 without having to send it to the voters. But in the event they don't, then you would see it on your ballot.
Daily Dose of Kindness now. A really big random act of kindness times two. CBS's Steve Hartman has more.
2 years ago, Eugene Yoon made the craziest decision of his life.
I remember kind of just like looking up at the sky and being like, God, are you sure about this? Because I'm pretty happy right now.
Did it feel like that, like a calling?
It felt like a calling.
What Eugene felt called to do was one really big random act of kindness. He didn't know who he was supposed to help or how. All he knew was that he had to help someone, and it had to be life-altering. And that's when a video came across his Facebook page.
As we first reported in 2015, it was a video of a guy he never met named Arthur Renowitzki. After being mugged, shot, and paralyzed 10 years ago, Arthur vowed that he would walk again someday. And when Eugene heard about that, he called Arthur immediately.
He wasn't going to give up until I was walking again.
To walk again.
To walk again.
And you don't have a medical degree.
I have a film degree.
Which makes you wonder, then, how were you going to make him walk again?
This is the part I had no idea.
Eventually, though, he learned about this exoskeleton device that can help some people walk again. Unfortunately, it costs about $80,000. So, to pay for it, Eugene quit his job at a research company in Northern California to hike.
Here we go.
From the California-Mexico border to Canada.
Here we go.
Along the way, he posted videos of the adventure and asked people to donate on social media. Until roundabout mid-Washington state.
We did it!
When Eugene learned.
We did it!
That he had reached his fundraising goal.
You're gonna walk!
A few weeks later, Arthur did walk. Right into the arms of a total stranger who made it all possible.
I'm so happy for you. Thank you, brother. I call him my brother now. We are brothers. I'm just very thankful to have a friend like him.
Since this story first aired, Eugene has been looking for another total stranger to help with another huge act of kindness. And here he is. Alberto Velasquez lives in poverty with 24 family members under one roof. Eugene met Alberto's family on Skid Row in Los Angeles and then hired Alberto, a skilled seamster, to help start a clothing line called Kin Love Gra. Proceeds will guarantee Alberto and his family a living wage and fund many other kindness projects to come.
Woo!
Eugene may have started with a walk.
Yes!
but is now clearly up and running.
And here he is, Danny O'Neill. It took 12 innings, but the Mariners did it. They beat the A's in Japan in a game in Japan that did not end until 7 o'clock our time this morning. That means the Mariners are 2-0. What are you seeing, Danny? Are you seeing stuff that that augurs well for the rest of the season? Is it a one-off? What do we think?
Well, first of all, let's celebrate the fielder's choice that scored the game-winning run that got D. Gordon home. Fielder's choice, because there's nothing quite as scintillating as a ground out that brings home the game-winning run. But no, look, here's the thing that I thought about this team, and we'll see how it pans out, is that I thought their bullpen was going to be a huge weakness. I thought the bullpen, and I thought it was going to start in game one when Nick Rumbelow came in and gave up a three-run homer to Chapman, that we were going to see that this team, it's got a good lineup, but it doesn't have a bullpen to be able to hold the lead in place. Totally wasn't true. The bullpen lasted through an extra innings game. They win 5-4. They come back 2-0. And yeah, you've got to feel pretty good about things. Plus, we got the proper farewell for Ichiro.
Yeah.
That was a really cool moment. He gets saluted in his home country, a pioneer of the game, and the Mariners come away from it 2-0.
So let's look at the rest of the division. What does this tell us about Oakland?
Well, Oakland, and it's a good point, because Oakland and Oakland's success last year was a huge reason that the Mariners decided, hey, we better take a step back. That if we go into this shooting for the second wild card next year, that we very well might be projected to be the number three team in the division and closer to being fourth than to being second, because Oakland had passed them last year, and Oakland is younger, i.e. cheaper. Oakland has some crisis, some challenges with its starting pitching, and I think that we saw that. I think they're going to hit okay, and I think they're going to be a good team. And Billy Beane, their GM, has shown an ability, and they have the young talent to upgrade their team over the course of the season. But if I'm an A's fan, and I believe that last year was the starting point for this new era of contention, I'm concerned about the starting pitching they have, because that doesn't project as well. If the bullpen is the Mariners' big question, the starting rotation is the A's huge question, and that can be a huge problem for a franchise.
And the rest of the division?
Well, Texas should be better, but I don't think anybody's going to vault up. And the Angels are a big question. The Angels have the best player in the game, Mike Trout. They just gave him $430 million. Can you imagine that? $430 million. Mike Trout's going to get paid more than the Sonics sold for. That's ridiculous.
That is amazing.
And you know what? And he's probably a bargain because of how good he is. They have Shohei Ohtani, who is still the dual sensation, but there's certainly some questions about his ability to be an effective pitcher. We're going to see. The Angels should be better this year. I'm not sure if they're going to be ready to contend yet. And then the Astros are the heavyweight of the division.
Yeah,
the Astros are one of the Astros and Red Sox are the two best teams in baseball to start this season.
By the way, that $430 million, that's over like 100 years, right?
Well, no, it's like 12, Dave. It's like 12. He's getting paid $36 million a year.
Oh my God. It's crazy.
It's so much, and every ounce of it is guaranteed. It's not like one of these made-up NFL contracts.
Seriously?
Like, hey,
wait a second. It's all guaranteed?
Yeah, he's going to get paid every dime of it.
So even if he's badly injured, God forbid, they could never trade him.
Yes, that's correct. Or if he became terrible,
wow.
Or if he just remains how he is, then that good. You know how many clients his agent has?
No.
One.
Yeah.
Mike Trout is his own economy.
Let's talk football for a moment. I saw a story that Doug Baldwin needs more surgery.
He does, and that was indicated. We saw a report on the NFL Network by Mike Garofalo that he's going to go be examined by a doctor in Philadelphia who specializes in sports hernias, or what are now being called core injuries. So kind of an abdominal muscle either pulling away or detaching from some of the pelvic bones. The expectation is he probably will end up having surgery to repair that. Here was the upshot that I took away from that, which is, it is not a slam dunk that Doug Baldwin's going to play next season. That he's been through enough and he's played through enough pain that I think he's at a point where it's a question of whether he wants to put his body through that or whether his body can go through that again. He's in his 30s. He's played now 8 seasons. And I know that the Seahawks will want him to play. I'm not sure if he's going to be if his body's going to be capable of making that. I hope so, because they're certainly not ready to move on from him. But I do think that he's been through enough. He's already had a shoulder surgery. He's already had a knee surgery. He played through a knee problem last year. It's not. Don't take it as a given that Doug Baldwin's back with the Seahawks.
Our Sports Insider brought to you by your Western Washington Auto Dealers. Danny, thank you.
You bet. Go Fairleigh Dickinson.
Something a lot of people don't know about airplanes is that the individual airlines, the customers, have a lot of options. For example, the airlines tell the manufacturer how much legroom to install, what kind of lighting should be in the cabin. But it also turns out, and this frankly surprised me, that they have options when it comes to which safety measures that they want installed. Which brings us to the two recent crashes of the 737 MAXs. Industry analyst Richard Abulafia with the Teal Group joins us live now. This is a piece in the New York Times this morning, Richard, about optional safety features. One of them, I believe, was designed to warn pilots of a disagreement between the two angle of attack sensors, which are suspected in these crashes. Why would something like this be only an option? Why would it not be standard?
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly going to be an issue moving forward. It sounds like they're already moving towards making it standard. But, you know, from the standpoint of the manufacturer, you've got the situation where the FAA didn't mandate it. No one else mandated it. And in the broader context of prices for jets, which have been coming down pretty steadily in real terms every year, the price of a new jet actually loses about 1 or 2% of its of value relative to inflation. They figured that, well, the only way to make that dynamic good is to charge for everything that wasn't absolutely mandatory. And, of course, this is an example of that.
This gets back to what, to me, is a very disturbing theme developing in the course of this story, which is that money came before safety. And I don't want to be unfair, because a lot of people work for Boeing, and they take their jobs and they take safety very seriously. But certainly, in hindsight, that looks like a mistake. I don't think that's what passengers expect either. For example, you see the part in the Times story about how the backup fire extinguisher in the cargo hold is an option, and that paragraph says because some fires potentially could not be controlled by the primary system. Well, I mean, why would it be an option if they know that the primary system cannot control all fires? As a passenger, I want all fires controlled. Why wouldn't the backup be mandatory?
Well, I mean, that when you say mandatory, that means the regulatory agencies would have to get involved and mandate it. And certainly there's an argument for that. The more we learn, the better off we'll be. And, of course, we'll make systems like this, hopefully, mandatory in that case. But, you know, the broader context, I think if I can speak for the safety regulators, which, you know, just from their standpoint, they do indeed make the system safer each year. You know, you look at the entire U.S. air transport system, every last bit of it, and we've just gone an entire decade with one single casualty. You know, you compare that with the car folks. Every day, almost a Boeing 737 is lost on the nation's roads. That's incredible.
Yep, fair point.
So they probably figured, you know, well, we could, there's some latitude for making things optional.
It's a fair point, and there's no question that the air crashes get outsized coverage if you simply look at the death toll. But for some reason, that doesn't change my mind. I understand that cars are far more deadly. But the thing about cars is that is most of the time because of the incompetence of the drivers, which is well known. And there's probably no safety measure. I mean, for example, if we had a lax system where anybody could basically walk in and fly a plane, that would be bad. We don't allow that at all. So the main vector for problems is going to be these mechanical failures, which I think is what makes it so important and why it's so surprising these things would be an option. Let me ask you this. Well, now that this story is there, what do you think Boeing should do?
Well, I think Boeing needs to work with the regulatory authorities and say, hey, look, maybe we're going a bit too far here, being a bit too cavalier about these features. Maybe they should be mandated. And, I'd be very surprised if more of these features now weren't standard moving forward. It could be that because of the incredible safety record that we've seen in the system over the past decade or longer, the downward trend, that maybe we've gotten a bit complacent. Yeah. I mean, that's quite possible, in which case this is exactly the sort of debate we should be having about the required safety features for a new production jet.
And I'm thinking about any possible competitive disadvantage to making planes more costly due to safety. I mean, what, is Airbus going to come back and say, hey, buy Airbus, we don't make you buy the safety features? I mean, they're not going to do that, right?
Well, yeah, it's sort of a, that's right. It's, you know, it's sort of a gospel of faith that you don't compete on safety.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, it all comes down to economics. Even if you're competing with, you know, hey, we throw in safety features, that's still an economic argument, right? I mean, it all comes down to what is your bottom line purchase price for this jet? And also what the airlines are willing to pay. Because remember, every year that price loss, that reduced price for a 737 or an A320 for that matter, is a function of airlines saying, yeah, we don't want that. We don't need that. We want the simplest, basic, cheapest jet we can get. In other words, there's sort of a, it's not just Boeing. It's also the regulators. It's the customers. It's everybody saying, when in doubt, let's make it cheap. And because of the tremendous reduction in incidents in this business, we can do that because it's so safe. Maybe we need to rethink of that process.
Yeah. I wouldn't say let's require every jet to have a giant parachute, right? But the idea that you could that somehow safety stops at a certain point. We decide, okay, we've now done all we can. That's never been a winning proposition. You're either going forward or you're going backward. But I don't think stasis is an option. Just my opinion.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I agree that there needs to be a debate here. But, you know, sometimes we go too far in the other direction. I remember after 9/11, there was a debate in Congress of whether or not they should install infrared countermeasures on planes, basically electronic warfare, like the kind that are installed on combat aircraft,
yeah, right,
to deflect any incoming surface-to-air missile.
Well,
that, to me, would have been a ridiculous expense and an unnecessary
true.
One. But the one we're having now, I think, is an extremely useful and valuable step, and hopefully we'll learn from this tragedy.
Industry analyst with the Thiel Group, Richard Abulafia. Richard, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
This is Seattle's Morning News. The baby boomers had this habit of giving blood on a regular basis, but it turns out that younger folks do not. And so Jim Aubuchon, the Bloodworks Northwest CEO, is trying some new strategies. What are you trying?
We are trying to reach out to young adults in places they normally go and doing things they normally do. For example, we went to the Comic-Con for several days and offered blood typing there to encourage people to think about blood donation. And we told them their blood type in response to getting their contact information. So we'll now be recruiting them as new donors. We go to a number of brewery festivals. Now, we don't collect blood there, but we, again, offer blood typing. One of our big successes has been working with the folks who put on the Georgetown Morgue event around Halloween time. And we have a couple Bloodmobile buses down there.
That's natural for the Georgetown Morgue.
We get a great turnout there. The other thing we're doing differently is using a new tool. For the donor, it will appear as an app on their smartphone. For us, it's a whole donor relationship system that allows us to see when we're needing blood of a particular blood type and then reaching out to eligible donors who have that blood type, knowing where they are, telling them we need that blood donated today, and finding a place close by to them with an open slot in a blood drive schedule so they can get in and out quickly and know that they're saving a life right now.
So you can take advantage of impulse giving, huh?
Well, I'm not sure it's impulsive, but we do know that the younger generations appreciate knowing that they are making a difference today. They'd like to know it's having an immediate impact. And indeed, when we have emergencies like the train derailment or the Aurora Bridge disaster, when we had many people showing up to donate, 3/4 of them were under the age of 40.
Yeah.
That's not the demographic that we see in between the emergencies.
Explain the generational difference and how the numbers have changed in terms of the number of regular donors.
We have great participation amongst high schoolers. About a fifth of all of our blood comes from high schoolers. But then we and other blood centers across the country, it's not peculiar to the Pacific Northwest, seem to lose touch with them during their early adult years. I understand they're busy, they're starting a career, maybe they're starting a family, and blood donation just isn't at the front of their mind. In the past, we got them back around age 40, and the major chunk of our donor population is 40 to 60. We've noticed over the last decade, they're not being replaced by the younger adults, so we're trying to change that. And it appears that we are beginning to have an impact, but we need more of an impact.
What's the attraction of giving blood? Because it is a needle stick, after all.
It is a needle stick, but it's just the knowledge that you're saving up to three lives in the space of an hour. The good that they are doing has a person at the other end of it who is going to go on living because of that donation. And we need 900 people a day donating blood.
That's just in this area?
That's just for BloodWorks Northwest, you know, in the I-5 corridor in Oregon and Washington.
Mm-hmm. How many do you get now?
Now, we're about 10% below what we need. We have been able to reach out to other blood centers in other parts of the country. The problem is that they don't always have blood to share.
Has it ever come to the point where the doctor says, sorry, out of blood?
We have been able to avoid having to postpone elective surgeries. We came very close to having to do that during the snowstorm. The problem is every unit of blood is not the same. There are eight different blood types, considering ABO and RH. And then for some patients, they need a specifically typed unit, one that is specifically matched for them if they have unusual antibodies. Right. And that's where we can get into trouble where it just isn't available because we need a large pool to draw from.
And before we wrap up, you're headed to Washington, D.C. Now, you're not being called on the carpet to testify by the Judiciary Committee or anything, I assume.
Thankfully, no. I'm taking the opportunity of the annual meeting of America's Blood Centers in our nation's capital to visit some of our congressional representatives and also some leaders in the Department of Health and Human Services, trying to impress upon them the importance of keeping the blood supply adequate and diverse.
You're also getting the Bill Conan Achievement Award from America's Blood Centers, so you're coming home with a trophy, too.
Well, that's very nice of them. I appreciate that.
Where's the app for people to download again?
If you text Blood App, all one word, to 91985, you'll get a download link. Or you can go to our website, bloodworksnw.org, and you can find it there.
You're still giving away snacks and juice at the end, right?
Oh, absolutely. And the cookies are good.
Dr. Jim Aubuchon, BloodWorks Northwest CEO. Jim, thank you.
Thank you.